Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
There once was a couple, Roy and Celestial. They were young, beautiful, highly educated, and upwardly mobile, living the dream in cosmopolitan Atlanta. Growing up Black in America, they understood the ways that racism had kept earlier generations from achieving all they could. But these young lovers, they were the embodiment of progress. Until, that is, a year and a half into their marriage, when a woman mistakenly identified Roy as her rapist and he was sentenced to 12 years behind bars for someone else's crime. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Roy and Celestial's story rings true on many levels, although it is a work of fiction, dreamed up by novelist Tayari Jones after a fellowship at Harvard where she studied the effects of race on criminal justice. She spent years processing what she learned, finally deciding to explore the nuances of the issue through the deeply personal lens of two complicated characters who are not archetypes, but specific individuals trying to make sense of a society that they didn't expect to betray them. Tayari Jones serves on the MFA faculty at Rutgers Newark. Her new book is called An American Marriage. Tayari, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
I love that the little spark that got you writing was just a snippet of conversation that you overheard.
Yes, I was at home in Atlanta in the mall, and I saw a young couple. The woman was splendidly dressed. I mean, she looked like she had just jumped out of a magazine. And the guy, he looked okay. But it was clear to me that they were in love and in trouble. And I overheard her say, clear as a bell, she said, "Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me for 7 years." And I was intrigued by this conflict, especially when he said back, he said, "I don't know what you're talking about because this wouldn't have happened to you in the first place." And I felt that they both had a legitimate point. And I know I have a novel when both characters are right, yet they don't agree.
That's the whole, the thing about this, what's really hard is that I couldn't decide in this tug of war. I would go from chapter to chapter and completely understand things from Roy's perspective. And then I would read things from Celestial's perspective and think, well, she's right here.
I mean, that is the real challenge of this situation. So Roy, you know, he's wrongfully incarcerated. And the reason we call it wrongful incarceration is because it's wrong. Something wrong has happened to him. And all he wants is a faithful woman. I'd say he's like Odysseus. He just wants to come home to a faithful woman and a clean house. But, you know, the Odyssey was written, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And this is a modern story. Celestial is a modern woman. And so they have such a hard time coming to a common ground on what is it fair to expect from one another.
So we won't spoil the whole plot here, but we will say that he's wrongfully incarcerated. Eventually, he's out and they have to sort of decide what to do with their relationship.
And he's out early.
Right.
I think that's important. Mm-hmm.
She feels like, she's not married because she doesn't have him living with her. They don't really have a life together after he's sent away. And there's this question of like whether they have faith in one another or whether they have faith in the marriage. And it seems like Roy, he loves Celestial. He understands she's not perfect, but he's idealized their relationship.
Well, yes. I mean, that's the thing. Roy is imprisoned, and so his romantic memory of their marriage is what keeps him going. And he feels like, I have been faithful to this marriage, and you should be faithful to this marriage too. But I mean, I think it's disingenuous not to point out that it's a whole lot easier for him to hold on to that marriage because it is all he has. Some people say to me, some readers say, well, Celestial is selfish. But I think the question is Roy selfish? Is it more selfish to want someone to wait for you? Or is it more selfish not to wait for someone? And again, they are both right and they don't agree.
I was thinking about the fact, Tayari, that if they had been separated by the fact that Roy were a workaholic and traveled all the time and she said, I just can't do this, we're not together, we don't have a real relationship, I wouldn't have thought to judge her.
I mean, that is the challenging thing, because when I was writing this novel, I originally wrote it all from Celestial's point of view. And there was a problem because people just kept saying, well, what about Roy? He's suffering so much. And that's when I decided to add his point of view to kind of round out the story, because it seemed like I wasn't telling the truth exactly when I didn't tell his story too. But I couldn't figure out why readers couldn't connect with Celestial at first. And I read all these other novels about women who were not being fulfilled by their marriages. And I discovered that almost all of them were novels written by and about white women in the suburbs. Hmm. Yes, and the husbands were workaholic and were not emotionally available. And when you read those, you rooted for the woman. But I realized it's because their husbands were not in trouble. And for the women to go for a life that's more fulfilling was kind of a feminist triumph in that circumstance. So then I thought, what are we saying, that Black women don't have access to feminism because their men suffer so that then their happiness is a luxury they can't afford? And what is the broader implication of that? So it kind of spun me out for a while trying to work out this conflict.
So this is simplified for us a little bit in terms of our sympathies, because we know, and sort of everyone who knows Roy knows from the beginning, that he has been wrongfully incarcerated. This is not a thing where we're really wondering if he did it. Although one key character in his life asks him one time, and it's devastating.
Yes, no one believes he did it, but whenever you are accused of anything, it gets in your head. Like, I'm sure you've seen it in your own life when people are accused of even the smallest thing. It becomes part of the file in your head about them. And his mother, she just wants to hear it from his lips. Tell me you didn't do this. And he's like, I shouldn't have to tell you, you're my mother. And she's like, I know you didn't do it, but I want to hear it from your lips. And that is the way that accusations, you know, even if you're innocent in the minds of the people you're talking to, the accusation taints you, it scars you. You never can quite get away from it.
There's also the reality that the criminal justice system leaves a lot of collateral victims, right? It's the person who is locked away. And it's also the family members, the people that depended on this individual.
You know, sometimes people ask me, how did you mix a love story with incarceration? And I'm like, that's not hard. Every incarcerated person is loved by someone. Anytime you take a person away from their life, I mean, we're all interconnected. And I was really interested in the collateral effects of this incarceration, more so than the incarceration itself. I mean, when I write a novel, I need to have a place, something that intrigues me and something that I want to unravel. And it was the collateral effects to me. I felt like I knew a lot after I did all this research about the effects on incarcerated people. But what about their families? What about their mothers? What about their brothers? You know, what about their dads? What about the community? What about our society?
Could you have done this same story if Roy had been guilty, not of something as sort of blatantly horrible as rape, but if he'd been like a white collar criminal and, you know, had done some insider trading or something and was rightfully locked away?
You know, I think that my research showed that there are very few people who are rightfully locked away, even if they did do some hanky-panky on their computer and, you know, switch some stocks over. The way that our prisons are just so horrific. But had he done the crime of which he was committed, I think the story would be quite similar, because for the person who's incarcerated, like for Roy, he wants his wife to remain his wife. I don't think that his feelings about it would change had he done some white collar crime, or had he, you know, done some, you know, getting caught with some, you know, wacky tobacco or something. I don't see how he would feel differently. And I don't see how, if the question is about the endurance of the wedding vows, I don't see how that would change. But I do think for the reader, there is a sense that because this wasn't his fault, as Roy says to Celestial, I'm innocent. But, you know, she says back, I'm innocent too.
Generations of characters in this novel recognize that things are a bit better for them than the generation that came before. And each set of parents or potential parents says, I'm not going to burden my kids with, you know, I had to pick cotton as a kid, or I, you know, your grandfather did this. They really want to continue just moving along and almost not thinking back to when things were harder. And so when the rug is pulled out from under Roy and Celestial, it's almost like they figured they had come so far that this couldn't happen to them. And of course, it still can because it's America.
Well, you know, as Celestial says, I know this happens to people, but by people, I didn't mean us.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, things are decidedly better for this generation than the previous. I mean, it's not a really subtle thing. Like, you know, my dad came of age during Jim Crow. I mean, despite the fact that my generation is, of course, still vulnerable to racism, there is a distinct difference. I don't want to be a person that says nothing has changed. A lot has changed and things have become more nuanced. But I do think that the challenge between these generations, and I think this really matters a lot for Celestial and her choices in her marriage, is that because of the progress of the generations, Celestial thinks she should be able to make decisions in order to be happy. And the earlier generation, they're like, happy? What is this happy you're talking about?
You just need to survive.
Yes, this isn't about being happy. This is about staying alive. This is about, you know, helping your husband stay alive. What is this? You want to be fulfilled? I mean, and that's a generation gap in my own life. I remember when I told my father that I wanted to go to graduate school to study creative writing because I was in a graduate program in literature. Like, they wanted me to be an English teacher. They wanted me to have a career, safe career, talking about books, and I wanted to write books.
Mm.
And I said I was unfulfilled. And Daddy said, you know your problem? You never had to pick cotton. He said, when you pick cotton, you don't stand out there saying, is this cotton fulfilling me? Is this field my niche? He said, you just pick the cotton. And I'm of the generation that doesn't want to just pick the cotton.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be fulfilled by my work. I want to be happy.
So did you say to yourself at that point, if I have kids, I am not going to talk to them about grandpa picking cotton?
Yes. Well, and also I never picked cotton, so I don't have to. I would have to. It would be a reach for me. But
yeah.
Daddy actually did it.
Yeah.
But there is a sense that we don't want to forget the past. But at the same time, there's a certain luxury in having the option of forgetting the past. And the question is forgetting the past an indulgence, or is forgetting the past a sign of progress? And I think that's a tension throughout the book. And frankly, I don't know if Celestial and Roy's situation would have been changed had they been more aware of the past. They perhaps would have been less surprised, but no less devastated.
You complicate this for us by letting us know that even when they are married, Roy, at the very least, allows himself to flirt with other women. We're never entirely clear about how much further it goes than that. So we're rooting for him, but we also know that he hasn't been the world's best husband.
He's like an average husband. You know, they've been married 18 months. He's good looking. He's got a good job. He's taken with himself. Everyone he's ever met in his life is taken with him. His mother adores him. His stepfather adores him. His teachers when he was in high school adores him. That man is well loved and he comports himself accordingly. And it's funny. Yeah, he's not perfect. It's so funny. People often say, oh, you've written these flawed characters. And I kind of feel like, what other kind of characters are out there? That's what makes people interesting. Their marriage isn't perfect. I didn't want them to be iconic like or archetypal like. This is a perfect couple. And now this terrible thing has happened and perfection has been lost. They're everyday people who are faced with an extraordinary challenge.
My guest is novelist Tayari Jones. She serves on the MFA faculty at Rutgers Newark. We're talking about her new book, which is called An American Marriage. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist Tayari Jones. Her new book is called An American Marriage. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. We're also on Twitter at @KERAThink. So, Tayari, Roy alludes to his suffering in prison, but we don't learn very much about it until the end of the book. And even then, we get kind of just a sketch of what he's been through. And I thought it was an interesting choice because it puts us as the readers in maybe the same position as everybody who cares about Roy. Like, maybe we think we can understand, but we'll never fully get a sense of what it was like for him.
Well, and also, I feel like when you read a book, you are vicariously experiencing what the characters experience. And prison is a harrowing experience. And as a writer and as a reader, I wanted to figure out how the reader can get the emotional sense of it without having to go to prison. I mean, I think that it's something, for example, if you think about Toni Morrison's Beloved, she does the same thing, but of course better. She is Toni Morrison. But when she talks about the slave experience in Beloved, she chooses things that emotionally describe what they've been through without walking us through all the torments. Because as a reader, that's just a lot to ask of your reader. You want your reader to walk away with understanding, but they don't need to walk away feeling like they have experienced it.
Before anything really bad has happened to them, you let us know that Roy is really interested in starting a family, like it's all he can think about. Celestial isn't sure she's ready yet, once they are apart, she really hits it big as an artist by creating these doll sculptures, and many of them look exactly like Roy as a baby.
I mean, yeah, she's an artist, and like many artists, even myself, we do kind of make our art toward our obsessions. But yes, Roy wants kids. I do think that sometimes we imagine that women are just dying to have children and that men are reluctant and that women want to use children to hold on to men. But the inverse is probably more true. A woman who has a child is more tied to the man than vice versa, I think. Even when Roy gets out, he thinks, you know, if I had a son waiting, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. I would just say to her, a son needs his father, and that would be the end of the conversation. You know, that this is a way that he can solidify that relationship that he's insecure about. So it is a very interesting thing to me, the way that parenthood works as, one, this hope for the future, but secondly, as a way of kind of making the relationship harder to leave.
She has a store where she sells these dolls, which are pricey, but, within reach of families. And then she has a fine arts practice, and she makes a really interesting decision for a gallery showing.
She makes a piece of art. She makes these dolls, and the dolls that look just like children, she sells in her store, and people buy them. They're kind of expensive, but not crazy expensive. And Roy's mother wants her to make one that is a replica of Roy. She even provides Roy's childhood outfit for her to put on the doll. So it's like Roy's mother wants her baby back. And Celeste makes it, and it doesn't move her as an artist. She's not inspired by it. But she gets the idea that she will dress the doll, which looks like Roy as a child, in prison clothing to make a statement. She says it's to make a statement about the prison industrial complex, and she wins a big prize. But really, I think it is her own musing about, was this inevitable? Was Roy a baby prisoner even when he was a baby? Were they foolish to think that they could ever escape this trap? And she gets a big prize for it, and Roy is furious. As a writer, I will tell you, people do not like to be the subject of your artwork unless it's just to say how awesome they are. Because when she was making portraits of Roy and they were just saying, look at my husband, isn't he amazing? He loved it. He said, I'm her manager and I'm her muse. But when her work started kind of reflecting her own mind, her own thoughts about his experience, he gets really mad.
How do you, I mean, I would think that as an artist, as you said, you're drawing on all kinds of things that have happened to you and people you know, and you take, you know, you sort of form characters out of composite parts, probably, of people you've known, and also things that you have just created for this character out of whole cloth. Do you have to prepare people for what they're going to read, if there are any similarities whatsoever? Like if your best friend always, you know, slices her bagel a certain way and you give that to a character that has nothing to do with your best friend, are you worried about that?
It's funny. I have a good friend and he said, and I borrowed a lot of his little quips. I talk to him every day for this book and he says, stop stealing what I say. And I say, I'm not stealing it. You can still keep saying it. It hasn't been stolen. But I can't tell if he's being funny or if he's really mad or someplace in between. And I very seldom write characters that are like real people. Like sometimes people say, who are the real people in this book? And they aren't really, but I do borrow funny things I hear or see. I don't normally mention it to anyone because I have found that people see themselves in the work even when you didn't make it about them.
Because there's a universality to what you're writing?
Yeah, and people just, you know, they just are into themselves.
Right.
But it is kind of a tricky thing, particularly when it's something that has emotional resonance. And I try to be mindful of it. But I did have one line that I borrowed from someone that I meant to take out. I meant to take it out and I forgot. I just used it as a placeholder and I forgot to take it out. And I saw her and she said, I have a question about page 200 and whatever. And as soon as I saw her, I knew exactly what it was. And I was so sorry because, I mean, it wasn't because it was meaningful to her. And I didn't mean to leave it in there. But she said it was fine and that she was pleased to be included. But I would not have taken that. And that was that she had said to her husband, I can't teach you how to feel feelings. And when she told me that, she was, you know, it was something that was that mattered to her. And I put it in the book, but I didn't mean to leave it in. I just forgot.
There is just a tiny little thread in this book. Roy and his father-in-law, to whom he's pretty close, have this idea that they're going to make a little extra cash by selling these T-shirts that say only in Atlanta. And by the time we see one, his father-in-law, it's old and the idea didn't really take off. And there's a real set of interesting questions to ask about what that means only in Atlanta for better and for worse.
Yeah, Atlanta is a very unique city. It's a southern city. And first, most people can't even get their heads wrapped around the idea of a southern city. The South is so associated with rural areas and kind of extreme poverty. And Atlanta has such a thriving Black middle class. It's where I grew up. And like I grew up in an environment where I asked for an elderly friend about a doctor. And she says, oh, I have a good doctor. She says he didn't go to Morehouse. But and she paused and she said, he went to Harvard and I do think that he's qualified. And that's an only in Atlanta kind of thing to say. Atlanta thinks of itself as a center of a certain universe. And that's what Roy is really drawn to. People think of the great African American migration as everybody kind of hightailing it up to Chicago or Detroit. But a lot of people moved to Atlanta because they wanted a new life. But they didn't want to leave the South. They're still Southerners. And in Atlanta, you can still be Southern, but still have opportunity.
So Celestial grew up in Atlanta.
Yes, we did. Me and Celestial.
She goes to an HBCU.
Yes, we did.
Me for and her Celestial. Undergrad. And then for graduate school, she doesn't. And suddenly she's in a really different space because she feels almost like a curiosity to many of her classmates.
Yes, this happened to Celestial and me. I mean, this is the thing. When you grow up in Atlanta, you can be very well in a majority Black environment that is cosmopolitan, educated, all these things. And you understand yourself. This is the best way I can explain it. Before I went to graduate school at the University of Iowa, I did not emotionally understand that Black people were a minority in America. I understood it the way when people tell you the world is 80% water. You're like, I guess, but if that's true, how am I sitting here on solid land?
Right.
And that's how I felt, like, because the numbers are about the same. You know, like the population is less than 20% Black. And I felt like, I get it, but how is that possible? And then when I got to graduate school, it was quite a culture shock. And I wanted more than anything just to go home, just like Celestial. She just wanted to go home.
So what did it, how did that reframe your sense of yourself as a Black woman?
I think that it reframed, like, for example, I see a lot of writers saying, oh, do you translate your cultural experience for another audience? I had never thought about translating anything. I wasn't aware there was anything that needed to be translated. And I feel like I've worked really hard to try to keep my Atlanta mind. Do you know how there's that Toni Morrison quote that says that they try to straighten out rivers by adding sand to the banks to make the river straight, and that the river finds its curves again? And she says something like, I want to be the way I was before I was straightened out. That's how I feel that after I left Atlanta, I'm constantly trying to be the person I was before I was straightened out.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Hannah is calling us from Dallas. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, guys. Love the show. I am calling because Oprah Winfrey has made her career on telling profoundly human stories. And she recently selected your book as her book of the month for her club and just raved about it. What did that mean to you, and how has that changed the experience of publishing a book and the reception for it?
Thanks for your call.
Well, first off, it's such an honor to be chosen by Oprah because I feel like she's a person of great integrity. And I think she has really excellent taste. And I am delighted. I mean, my book has been exposed to so many new people. But at the same time, there's also a huge responsibility in that Oprah Winfrey has loaned her good name to my project and what I'm doing. And it has kind of caused me to raise the bar in thinking about, you know, how am I talking about this book? To whom am I talking about this book? So I want to make sure that I incorporate more outreach into my book tour so that the book can reach people who may need to read it.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist Tayari Jones. We're talking about her new book, An American Marriage. What did Oprah want to talk about when you discussed the novel?
Well, she just called me on the telephone. I was driving my car, minding my business, and I got a call, and it said block call. And I'm the kind of person that when I see a block call, I am intrigued.
Oh.
So I was like, yes? And she said, hi, this is Oprah. And I would recognize that voice anywhere. Anybody would. It's so distinct. And, you know, she just wanted to talk about, well, she asked me, how would I like to be part of the book club? And like any good Southerner, I said, yes, ma'am. And she just talked about that she had shared the book with her girls at her South African school, and that she really liked that book because it talked about the family and the way that it wasn't about prison, it was about people. It's like what my writing teacher once told me. He said, always write about people and their problems, not problems and their people. And this seemed to be what appealed to Oprah. And she also really liked the title, which pleased me.
Fathers and fatherhood are an important theme in this book. You have, and we haven't even talked about Andre, and we'll get to him, but you have certainly Roy really valuing the father who raised him, finding a kind of surrogate figure in his prison cellmate, and really looking to an older generation to try and figure his way out in the world.
Well, you know, I'm very close to my own father, and I find my father to be kind of endlessly fascinating. Like Roy, my father is from a small Louisiana town, and he migrated to Atlanta as the promised land. And so I've always almost felt like my father's from not another country, but in a way, like my father has a whole life in the old country that as his Atlanta child, I know nothing about. And so I borrowed that for Roy. And just the way that men look to one another as role models and the limitations of the question of role models. He does look to this older generation for wisdom, but also it's very comforting to him because all the stress, emotional stress in his life, a lot of it comes from people imposing kind of new ideas on what Roy has, which is a very old school conflict. You know, he's a Black man in prison because he has been accused of rape. You know, that's like a problem that was ripped from the headlines from the 40s or 50s. And so he is able to relate to these older men more who kind of have considered these issues in a way that he hadn't. But at the same time, no one can help him deal with Celestial, his wife, who is a modern woman trying to figure out her role in this problem that Roy has.
So Celestial is independent. Multiple people in her life make the point that she's not owned by anybody. She doesn't belong to anybody. She's independent. Some of her success comes from the fact that she has been supported by her father and then for a while by her husband, who wants to sort of allow her to do her art without having to work until he goes to prison. What do you think she doesn't understand about where she is?
I think that she doesn't understand, or I don't know if it does that she doesn't understand it, but she doesn't know what it is she's supposed to do about it. Like, I think she is aware that she's a person of privilege because her dad is this mad scientist inventor who has made all this money. And so she knows that she's benefited from this money and this position. But I don't think she feels like, and therefore I should do what? Should I not take advantage of what my father's hard work has made? You know, her family, her dad, he feels like, I'm this rich guy, and what I'm doing with my money is I'm setting my daughter up so that she can be successful. So it's a really a kind of a strange thing, because that is the promise of the previous generation, that, as Roy calls it, a leg up American style. But I think that she isn't sure what then is her, like, how does that change her responsibility to Roy? Should she not pursue her dream because he can't pursue his? Like, would that somehow even the score, or would that be squandering the hard work of her father?
Yeah, and it really is challenging with Celestial and Roy, because they are in these terrible circumstances by no fault of their own. It would be so much easier. It would be so much easier if somehow one of them were culpable, but they're not. They're in this terrible position, and there's nothing they can do about it, or nothing they think they can do about it.
Yes, I mean, he says, I'm innocent. She says, I'm innocent too. And don't you think, like, she is able not to work because of Roy, but don't you think she's just indulging him because her dad, I mean, her family would have...
She could have been able to work even without Roy.
Yes, and she's indulging him because he wants to feel like, that is the thing, I think, that he wants to feel like he is enabling her career. That is his way of having ownership of what she's doing as well. And she's indulging him in that, I think.
Yeah, because it tells him he's arrived.
Yes.
My guest is novelist Tyari Jones. She serves on the MFA faculty at Rutgers Newark. Her new book is called An American Marriage. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or go to Twitter. We are at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist Tyari Jones, who serves on the MFA faculty at Rutgers Newark. Her book, An American Marriage, tells the story of Roy and Celestial, a young black couple in Atlanta separated by his wrongful imprisonment. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. I was floored by the fact that Roy isn't really angry at the woman who falsely accused him.
You know, that was a big decision for me, but first I thought it wasn't that interesting to me. I felt like I didn't want this to become whether or not women lie or not lie, particularly when people are talking. I know we're in the moment of Me Too, and it's believe women, and I do. In the case of attacks by strangers, because most of the things in the Me Too movement, people know exactly.
Sure.
It's someone they know. Mm-hmm. In the case of stranger attacks, it's a lot more complicated in that your own memory can be manipulated by the way evidence is presented to you. And that's what happened to Roy. It was a dirty lineup. And then it just reinforced in her mind. Like, she was told this is the person, and it was reinforced in her mind. But I just wasn't interested in relitigating that old story. I felt like it could easily take us off track from the story that was really burning in my heart, which is what happens to Celestial and Roy? What is their obligation to each other? I didn't want to scapegoat the woman. And if you notice, I do not identify her racially.
You know, it's funny because I read the book and I didn't know whether she was black or white or Asian or Latina. But I read a couple of reviews and people said he was falsely imprisoned for raping a white woman. And I wondered where that came from, if people read that and assumed that you had chosen that narrative.
I'm like, you know where that came from.
From not reading the book sometimes.
Well, no, also, it's a very old narrative. Mm-hmm. And I just really wanted to avoid that. And so I just didn't identify her because I just didn't want all eyes over there. I didn't want her to hijack the story of Celestial and Roy and Andre.
All right, let's talk about Andre. So Andre and Celestial grow up next door to one another for much of their childhoods. They remain friends forever. You know, if in her 20s Celestial had been asked about Andre, she would have said, "We're best friends," and maybe not acknowledged anything more than a platonic friendship. I think if you put a couple of beers into Andre, he would have said he'd always been in love with her.
I think so. I think a beer and a half. I think Andre could look at a beer and suddenly start talking about how much he's always loved Celestial all his life. But yeah, they were babies together. They used to take a bath together in the sink. And there's a point where Roy says, "Do not tell me about that sink one more time." Because they, you know, that is Andre's kind of justification. He's like, "I've known her all my life." And again, I mean, obviously they fall in love. Well, Andre's been in love since this whole thing started. But I feel like Roy's imprisonment has made every narrative for Celestial so problematic. Like, that is an established romantic trope, that there's someone there all along and you didn't know until one day, you know, you look across the room and there's Andre. And people will accept that as true love. But because Roy is in the picture, some readers say things, really unkind things about Andre that hurt my feelings. They say, "Oh, he was just waiting in the cut. Oh, Andre just slid in when Roy was away." And I just realize how Roy's suffering makes everyone who is not suffering suspect to so many people. And that is the real challenge of their lives. Like, can they be in love?
There's always that they're denied the simplicity of that meet cute story, though. You know what I mean?
Because
it's there. It's like if you've ever known somebody who's on their second marriage or one of the partners is, and one person was married to somebody else when they first met. I mean, they can be really in love and meant for each other, but there's that little thing where they always have to sort of lower their voice and tell the story, and only to some people.
Just as Celestial's parents were
right,
like that.
Right.
That's how Celestial's parents got married. And yes, there's this thing like it's somehow delegitimized because it was not born under ideal circumstances, but we all know in real life that people get together in all kinds of ways. But with Roy being in prison, it almost feels like a racial betrayal to be in love with Celestial, even though he was in love with Celestial before he ever laid eyes on Roy. Roy's suffering just takes primacy over everything. And one of the questions of this novel is, should it? And I really wrestled with that a lot as I was writing it because, I mean, what happened to Roy? I mean, this is a historic injustice. But, you know, when you're in love or at the end of the day, it's like, who are you eating dinner with? Who are you going to bed with at night? You don't go to bed with an idea, an injustice. You don't eat breakfast in the morning. You don't pour a bowl of cereal for a problem. You pour a bowl of cereal for a person. So how do you do it? What do you owe each other?
So Roy is released from prison earlier than was expected, but he and Celestial both are struck by the diminishment of his appearance. He was, as you mentioned, he was someone who sort of, I think, charmed people with his personality, but also with his looks. He made a lot of money in his job, and that gave him a certain amount of confidence. And when you send him back to Atlanta, he's in like a Walmart polo shirt and khakis, and they don't quite fit the way they used to, and he's thinner, and you remind us that he's lost a tooth. And it just made me think about the fact that no matter what, even though theoretically it's the happy ending that he's out sooner than the full extent of this unfair sentence, there's a change in him that cannot be erased.
Yes, I mean, he comes out, he is, like Celestial says, sometimes she sees men and she thinks, catches her eyes. This is Roy. But no, because the Roy she remembers is not the Roy who is back. And she's changed too. I mean, he has the same thing. He mistakes her young assistant for her. And he realized that, no, the young assistant looks like the woman I used to know, but it's not who she is now. And just like the man in the story tells her, when Celestial confesses her whole sad story to a man who's shopping in the store, and he listens and he says, I hear you. He said, that incarceration thing is deep, but time is the original challenge. And that and that's true. They've been apart 5 years, incarcerated or no. That's a lot of time. There are a lot of changes.
Roy is really frozen when he's in prison, and he's writing these beautiful letters, and his letters all look backward, and Celestial's life continues to move forward.
I mean, that's the thing. Yes, he is kind of living in kind of a Groundhog's Day, the same. I mean, the part of the torture of prison is how monotonous it is and how things don't move forward in the same way. But Celestial, she's, what, 27, 28 when it starts. There's so much happening to her. She's becoming famous. Her dreams are becoming real. Her life is a moving, growing thing. And so it's. When I think about them writing letters, I chose letters because it shows they just have a tiny piece of paper on which to make a relationship, a literal small canvas. And that's the challenge, really. And I almost think it's almost unfair to both of them that they have to try. They try so hard. I hope that when we talk about this, it doesn't seem like Celeste is like, later, I'm about to have a career. She tries so hard.
I want to talk a little bit about the fact that this is, much of the story is told in letters. How do you get yourself into the voice, not just of these specific characters, but of people as they're changing? So you have to keep Roy, but you also have to reflect the way he's changing and the way he uses language as time goes on.
Well, I sometimes joke and say, I spent 6 years writing this book. Roy wasn't in prison, but 5 years. So I probably changed as much as he did as I was working on it. But also, I read the letters aloud. And I'm a letter writer in real life. Mm-hmm. And hardly anyone writes me back.
Oh.
No, people, I mail 5 or 6 letters a week. I probably receive 2 or 3 letters a month.
Who do you write to?
Oh, all kinds of people. I write to my mother every Sunday because she really enjoys that. I write to friends. I write to people I meet. I write to people whose business cards I have. I just enjoy it. Or if I see on Facebook someone is struggling, I'll write them a paper letter and mail it to their house because I feel like it's a different kind of correspondence. But so because I am a letter writer, I do think that form comes easily for me. And prison is one of the last storylines where you can use letters, modern storylines, where you can use letters organically.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist Tayari Jones. Her new book is called An American Marriage. You may know this. Journalists get a lot of letters, not a lot, but letters from folks who are incarcerated and read their work or whatever. And I am always struck by just how it seems like they're written by people who are very good writers. And some of them may be like Roy and had education before, and some people are sort of these autodidacts who apply the time that they have to gaining these skills. And there's a poignancy. Roy in prison is able to like get himself some extra snacks or resources by helping people write letters.
Yes. I mean, in that way, too, it really, there's so many things in the prison system that also remind you of antebellum experiences. Like during slavery and even during Reconstruction, there were a few Black people who could read and write, and they would take assignments to write letters for others. And you understood that you were giving voice to another person. It's kind of a sacred duty. And I get letters from prisoners. I've always gotten letters from people who are in prison. And I used to not always answer them. I was a little worried, like, how does this person know where I am? But then, I made friends with the poet, Nikki Giovanni, who corresponds with many incarcerated people. And she said to me, you should always write them back because you don't know how difficult it was for them to get the stamp, the paper, the letter, the envelope. You don't know how much effort is in that letter. And the least you can do is respond. And so I always respond, and I'll send if it's near a holiday, I'll send an Easter card or Christmas card or something, because the mail is so important to people who are incarcerated.
The other thing this book made me think a lot about was there are subtle but really important class differences among some of the characters in this book. You mentioned being raised middle class in Atlanta by a father who picked cotton as a kid, maybe didn't have the same resources. I think that no one expects me as a white woman to sort of really be able to fully relate to the experience of really poor white people. And it's an assumption made, I think, a lot of times about Black Americans.
Well, I do think that, I mean, there's so much class diversity in my extended family. Mm-hmm. I have 43 first cousins. And I like to say anything you can think of, I have a first cousin that's doing it. And so it isn't that big of a leap for me to imagine a poor or working class life. I just call it my relatives. But also, I do think that, like, growing up in Atlanta in a largely segregated city, I grew up in Southwest Atlanta, and the class range in that quadrant of the city is incredible. You have people living in, you have famous people living in literal mansions, but you also have people living in Section 8 subsidized housing in Southwest Atlanta. So I think that assumption that you could relate to other experiences is probably due to a homogenization of the Black experience, but it's one of those times when it does hold up because of housing.
I read somewhere that it says in your bio that you're teaching at Rutgers. Maybe now, after having an Oprah book, you could afford to not teach, but it sounds like it's really important to you to continue with that.
Oh, I will always teach. My parents are both professors, so it's the family business. But also, I mean, it's meaningful work. I wouldn't give up teaching in the same way that I wouldn't say, I've made so much money now I don't have to write anymore. It's part of what I do. Teachers change my life. When I teach, particularly undergraduates, I feel like I'm adding one more story to the world. I feel that we need more stories. We need more diverse people in terms of age, race, class, all of this. We need more stories. So when I teach, I'm helping out, and I'm helping someone else find a way to do what they love.
We started the hour talking about how you heard this tiny snippet of conversation that set you writing here after doing a lot of other research. It's worth noting. Are you a collector of observations?
I'm nosy. Is that what you mean? Yes.
I mean, are you this sort of person who would, you know, sit down on a bench in the mall and just see what you can see?
I find that I don't even have to try to find experiences. If you just become like a noticer, people are acting out all kinds of dramas right before our very eyes. Because especially people in love, they cannot control themselves. They just let it all hang out in the mall, in the grocery store. Your Uber driver, sometimes he can't help himself. He'll have to tell you the whole story. And when he does, I am all ears.
Novelist Tyari Jones serves on the MFA faculty at Rutgers Newark. Her new book is called An American Marriage. Tyari, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
This is a lot of fun. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find the podcast anywhere you can find podcasts. If you are also interested in archives of the show, go to think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.